This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Today we brought the show onto the road. We traveled north from our usual studio space to Punta Gorda, a harbor town in Charlotte County where a love of fishing is almost required. But we're here today to mark the 50th anniversary of the death of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. That anniversary is tomorrow, and PBS is marking that by airing two specials tonight. At 8 p.m. WGCU-TV is showing Roads to Memphis, and at 9 p.m. Black America Since MLK. And today, Gulf Coast Live is at the Blanchard House Museum, which is a site along the Florida Black Heritage Trail. It's a home that was built in 1925, a bungalow that was first owned by Joseph Blanchard, a local African-American fisherman, and his wife Minnie, who was a mail-order bride from New Orleans. It's now the Blanchard House Museum of African-American History and Culture of Charlotte County. The museum director is Dr. Martha Bereda. She is here with us today. Martha, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you so much for choosing the Blanchard House to do this broadcast. We're very excited.
I think it's a little-known gem, so I'm excited to let people know more about it. And we're also joined today by Jaha Cummings. He's a current Punta Gorda City Council member and the son of Dr. Bereda. Jaha, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. This is wonderful.
We are marking the anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s death with a live program at the Blanchard House Museum in Punta Gorda today. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. And also be sure to check Twitter for some photos from the museum here. So Martha and Jaha, we're here in what would be the front room or like the living room of the home. And the floors look like they're original wood. It's a modest, small home. Tell me how this came to be a museum of African-American history in Charlotte County. Martha?
Well, on the wall prominently featured here is my mother, Bernice Andrews Russell. And my mother, my family has been here since 1885. My mother was very, very proud of that heritage. And it happened actually during the bicentennial that she first wanted to highlight the history of African Americans and started doing that. She would take her little exhibits around to the bank and to the first at the depot. But the Blanchards both were deceased. They had two daughters who lived, Myrtle and Beatrice, who lived in New Orleans. Neither of those girls had children. Those were Mrs. Blanchard's daughters. So when the girls died, there were no heirs. And my mother and her family had been friends of the Blanchards. And so mother bought the house in, it's adverse possession, the taxes and whatnot. So she bought the house in 1997, and her dearest dream was to have an African-American museum. She absolutely felt it was important to show that there was no Punta Gorda history without African-Americans. And she wanted to be able to show the contributions of African-Americans to the history, the culture, and the development of Punta Gorda. So when she died in 1999, I was still working and traveling, but I came home in 2001 and talked to a group of people like U.S. Cleveland and Mr. Wartiski and a few other people and Dr. Shedd, and we gathered a group who were interested in my mother's dream and established the Bernice Russell Center. And from that, we already had the house. We were given awarded $25,000 from the city of Punta Gorda to move the house and $25,000 to renovate the house.
So this house originally stood somewhere else?
Yes, this house stood at 623 Fitzhugh, which is about two blocks over.
Oh, okay.
And it was the wisdom of Mr. Wartiski who said, Martha, we got to move that house. We need to move it to a street so that we can revitalize the community. And so we moved it to what was by then had become Dr. Martin Luther King Street, which is right out front here.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great day, May 20th, 2002. One of our dear friends, Gordon Bowers, was a reporter, and we followed the house on the truck being moved from Fitzhugh. So there's a whole group of people behind the house as it was moved to this location.
Were you so nervous that it was going to fall off the truck or something? I mean, that's kind of scary moving a house.
Yes, it was, because this was an old house that
yeah.
was not in the best of conditions. But we got it here, and that was 2002. By 2004, thanks to all of the wonderful volunteers, and I think this too is a tribute to my mother, the people who came out and volunteered. This was an old house that was in bad condition, and people in Ponta Gorda, this is why we're special here, people from all over Ponta Gorda came and contributed to the establishment of this museum, and we're so proud of them and of our community.
So what we're seeing on the walls, these are great black and white pictures. These are old photos and little snippets of information. Is this what your mom used to travel around and share with people down at the depot? And it was kind of her mobile museum, but Now it has a permanent home.
Yes, she had panels, and she would put her pictures on the panels and would take it and travel with it.
So it was kind of her life's mission. And so she was friends with the Blanchards.
Yes, my grandparents and the Blanchards were very close friends. So my mother really grew up with the Blanchards. And I'll tell you a little story. When I was 13, I took typing and learned to type. And on the front porch, which now is, this house is very different, by the way. Mrs. Blanchard had the house was totally dark, very thick, heavy drapes on all of the windows, very dark. The front porch had like a dark screen, so you sat there. But when I, at Christmas time, she would give me $1 to type her names on her Christmas cards and to get those ready to send out. So I also knew Mrs. Blanchard and had a relationship with her.
So according to the website, she was a mail order bride from New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find, this is something they just talked about?
Well, it's something that my mother knew, but as I look into the history of African-American men, especially fishermen here, fishermen did very well. That was one of the independent entrepreneur-type jobs that these men, remember, these were the children of ex-slaves. And the one thing that the slaves always said is that they wanted to see the fruits of their labor. So these men could come to Ponta Gorda, could make themselves a little fishing boat, and there was a certain freedom. And so not only was there that freedom, but we were a fishing town. We were sending fish all up the East Coast. So fishermen had the reputation for making good money. My great aunt from Mariana. So don't ask me how I know these things, or how they knew these things. Somehow in Mariana, Florida, Aunt Annie, Mr. Fisherman, Mr. Roberts died. She came all the way from North Florida, married him.
And so they were the leading businessmen, kind of, you know, and then there was a draft for that kind of stability.
Yes. And so Mr. I don't know how he did it, but somehow I guess the word passed that here was a town where women could find good men, because Mrs. Blanchard, of course, you know, had daughters. My Aunt Annie, you know, helped to take over a family. And then Dan Smith, who was one of the first African-Americans to come to Ponta Gorda, his second wife, I understand from one of the family members, was also a mail order bride. So that seemed to be what was happening. That's a history story in itself.
That's interesting. And so you mentioned Mr. Smith. Was he here as Trabue was here?
He came at the same time. Trabue was here. Mm-hmm. And in 1885, they were going to bring the railroad here. And he came under the tutelage of Albert Gilchrist, who trained these men to survey for the railroad. So at that time, there were 15 men here. Eight were white and five were black.
Yeah, the census. I loved reading that on the census. Like 15 entire people. Eight were white, seven were black.
And so they, Dan Smith came, and he was, one of the people who was very important here in establishing Ponta Gorda. I mean, he did also an entrepreneur. He was a fisherman. He had groves. And so there was a very interesting, and I'm sure this happened in other African-American communities too, but by this being a fishing village, there were the turpentine steels and whatnot, but they were outside of town. This created an entirely different atmosphere for African Americans. That whole sharecropper mentality was never able to develop here, because, you know, if you know fishermen or shrimpers, they have an entirely different personality. They need that kind of freedom. And so that whole the industry helped this different kind of relationship and freedom to develop.
And Jaha, we were talking last week when I was up here, you were talking about being fishermen and how that kind of contributes to the sea being a great equalizer, too. If you're out there on the water, you don't see somebody as different so much if you need help, or if you know?
That was one of the things with the founding of the city, is that a lot of the people were fishermen, and that kind of, it's like people being in the military. It doesn't serve you any good to have any kind of racial hierarchies and things like that. And so these men worked together, both on land and off land, and they were able to develop a town, you know, based off of this actual relationship. And so I think that's why some of the dynamics, despite it being the middle of Jim Crow, it didn't really, these things were not applied like they were throughout the rest of the South, because it just wasn't practical. There were pre-existing relationships that were workable already.
Well, it's interesting. It sounds different from all of the history that we're taught, or that I at least was taught in school. Is the situation in the South was very Jim Crow. However, here you have on the walls images of people from throughout the history. For example, 1889, the postmaster was Robert Meacham, the former Florida senator.
And this is a big deal, because think about this. Rutherford Hayes became president. His deal for becoming president was basically turning the South back over. And so Reconstruction was essentially over. But here, Reconstruction didn't end, because just the people of this town were fine with having, you know, someone like him.
I think it's really incredibly interesting. And I want somebody to tell me the story of George Brown. Martha, would you tell me a little bit about George Brown?
George Brown, and he assumed from South Carolina, Savannah, one of those areas. He came in, and he was doing some work here, and he was a carpenter. And he eventually established his own steamways, and steamways was out in Cleveland. And it was the largest steamways here in Southwest Florida. Now, what is remarkable about George Brown was that he was one of the largest employers here. And the amazing thing, now remember, we still had Jim Crow in, you know, the 1885 in that area. The Jim Crow laws were definitely put in place, and Florida was one of the first to put the most stringent Jim Crow laws.
Well, down at the depot, there's a very serious delineation. There's a wall that you can't see over.
Yes. And that depot is still like that because of my mother. My mother said, we must tell the history.
And don't forget. So she championed that staying.
Yes.
So, George Brown, he did really well.
Yes, I've heard stories. We had some oral histories done about a couple of years ago, and some of the old timers who were working collecting taxes and all. And of course, these were not colored people at the time; these were whites. And they would say, when the city and the county needed money, when they ran out of money, they would go to George Brown and ask him to please pay his taxes early. And he was one of the I have heard and read, one of the few or the only African-American who was referred to as Mr. Brown, and who could go down to the drugstore and have a cone of ice cream and sit down. Well, he was a major employer, and people like Mr. U.S. Cleveland, who was a historian here, would tell me stories of how his uncles worked for George Brown. From everything that I have heard and read, these men worked together. And the one thing that was not done in the South was to pay black men the same wages as white men. George Brown paid equal wages for equal work. And so that in itself, the fact that he, you know, you take cities like Tulsa, Oklahoma, that you had a large black middle class, an elite class. The town was burned. In this town, I've never heard of anybody threatening to burn down George Brown's steamways. Well, first of all, people wouldn't have had jobs had they burned down the steamways. Mm-hmm. But the only thing that did happen to him was he had built a very elaborate house in Cleveland that, you know, according to the lifestyle of a man of his means. And the word did get back to him that that was not a suitable establishment for a colored man. And George Brown, knowing where he lived, knowing he had a business and all, he built a more modest home, which was a very nice home. But my family, my grandmother and Mrs. Brown were close friends. So we're, you know, I used to visit that home. But that was the only thing that I ever heard. And I don't think that he was ever any damage or anything like that was ever done to him. But he said, you know, okay.
Well, there was one building that burned, Jaha, you were telling me about when I was here last week, and that was one
the big house.
The big house. What's the story with the big house?
Well, I am actually looking into the history of Mr. Henry Samuel because I've gotten this this interest. And I don't know if you're familiar with the policy gambling or the gambling rackets. Well, this was a cultural adaptation for African Americans. It was a kind of a mutual benefit society. It involved gambling, but people had the opportunity, you know, like a 6-to-1 ratio. And for a penny, you could get $6 back if your number hit. It was a numbers racket. Well, anyway, I am fascinated with Mr. Samuel because he came here in the 20s. Think of this now, a colored man with $80,000.
So he allegedly came to town with $80,000 in his pocket.
That's what every story that's ever been told about Mr. Samuels. He owned, built grocery stores, had all the housing along the Virginia here. He owned housing, owned a hotel, a gas station, a meat market, a billiard place. He put that money in, which was very interesting, into the economic development of this town. Now, I say, considering the years that he came and considering the fact that as a cultural phenomenon, playing the numbers was what helped many African American communities to become established because you could go to the banker, the banker of the numbers, and people who were not able to get money from a white bank, you could go to your colored,
like a loan shark.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, they weren't like loan sharks. They gave to the community. They gave to churches. It was not a, okay.
This kind is of like an unregulated bank.
Yes,
maybe.
It was unregulated. But the thing that's very interesting, in the eyes of the white community and in the eyes of the law, it was illegal. In the eyes of black people, this was not seen to be illegal.
It was kind of like their only option, really.
It was the only option. So when Mr. Samuel came here, and I've just gotten a book written by W.E.B. Du Bois called The Philadelphia Negro, and I just had to look it up. And so from 1897, the numbers racket was really heavy in that area, and he came from Philadelphia, so I've got to do more work on him. But if you could see his picture here, he's this big guy
in a nice suit,
and of course he was wearing a very nice suit. But he was two fascinating people here in Ponta Gorda to me, but he was one of the fascinating ones, and I become more and more fascinated after I learned about the numbers racket and how. And I'm sure it happened here in Ponta Gorda, how the numbers racket was the only way that African Americans survived during the Depression. It's because these bankers hired them when they couldn't get work first fired, they couldn't get work anywhere. In some cities like Chicago or Detroit, you'd have 15,000 people who were involved as runners. So that's a topic that you all may want to explore sometime.
I know. I'm just going to sit here and talk for all day.
But also with that, George Brown actually during the Depression was one of the employers that kept people employed during that time.
Yes.
As well as he's the one who donated the land that became the county courthouse when Charlotte County became a county.
Mm-hmm.
Because before, you know, it was DeSoto County before.
So when I'm hearing all this history about Ponta Gorda and Charlotte County, I guess it shouldn't come as a surprise that it was the first county to embrace desegregation in schools. Other counties kind of got, you know, forced. But this county said, oh, okay, sure. Is that because, do you feel like it's because that was just a way of life,
a way of being? The parents themselves decided to do this. This was just our society was such that way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe it being just a way of life is maybe more of a way to enact a change rather than imposing.
Yes. And, you know, we don't want to say that there was no Jim Crow because there was.
There was.
Yeah, there was Jim Crow.
But just not as much as places.
The relationships, especially from the older people that came here, the first religious service was held, integrated service was held by Dan Smith, you know. And so everybody came to it. And back in the 40s, when my father came, and he was in the soldier, and he wanted to marry my mother. And my mother was 20. And Judge Rose, who was a friend of the family, he called my grandfather. He said, "Richard, do you know Bernice is getting married?" And like father to father, that was the kind of relationships that existed here. Mm-hmm. And I heard from some of the young men that, you know, they played ball together. And I guess somebody, I think they were even down by Gilchrist. And so somebody got, you know, a little upset that they were playing together. The boys just said, you know, just go away. They kept playing. You know, just
Well, we're going to take a quick break, but when we return, WGCU's Jessica Mazaros will take us to Manatee Mineral Spring Park, where archaeologists are searching for remnants of a community called Angola, way before all of the history that we're talking about right now. I'm Julie Glennon. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. This week, WGCU reporter Jessica Mazaros had an opportunity to visit the Manatee Mineral Springs Park, which has been the subject of a multi-decade study where they're searching for remnants of a community called Angola. It was a settlement and community of escaped slaves who came to the area because it was still Spanish territory where slavery was not legal. Jessica talked with archaeologist Sherry Svekas and park preserver Trudy Williams. Here's that conversation which they had as they toured the area.
Where are we standing right now?
At the Manatee Mineral Spring in Bradenton, Florida.
And for those who have never been here, how would you describe it? What kind of wildlife are we seeing here on this breezy day in Florida?
Well, this is a gorgeous Florida spring day, and we are like one block north of the Manatee River, which is very important to the story of this place, and standing in a small park, which is here because of the Manatee Mineral Spring. And we know that this spring was key to any group of people who lived, worked, traveled, explored this area. Right now it's a community park owned by the city of Bradenton. And we've got large trees, we've got palm trees, we've got birds in the distance. Can see the river from where we're standing.
And there's some Spanish moss, I see.
Yes, there's Spanish moss hanging from the oak trees. And we have a cat's claw tree that we're in the shade under at the moment. We can see a cane field. It's a demonstration cane field, which demonstrates some of Florida's pioneer history. And around us is the neighborhood of East Manatee.
And what is the historical significance recently announced about this park?
So recently announced is that this property is not only connected with the history of the town of Bradenton, but earlier than that, in the 1810s, it was a key community for slaves who had escaped the what was then the United States and came into Florida to live in the freedom. And they eventually made their way south to the banks of the Manatee River. So these people brought their families, escaped battles in northern Florida to come south, made their way and made a community here for a number of years alongside the Manatee River. Because of that, we were approached by the National Park Service to designate this spot as a spot of the Underground Railroad. And many people don't realize that the Underground Railroad is not considered just north across the Ohio River to freedom and to Canada, but also, there were many people who escaped south into what was then Spanish territory. And they lived in freedom for a number of years here in what was Spanish territory until the Florida was ceded to the United States. And that was effectuated in 1821.
And so how do we know about this history? I mean, this is something new that we've heard about?
It's something that historians and archaeologists, anthropologists have been working on really for the last 30 years. Parts of this story have been known. The historian Cantor Brown was the first one really to pull together the history on it and tell the story of this, putting together both British documents, a newspaper article from Charleston, South Carolina, of the slave raid that destroyed this community. He put together that story. Then a local historian kind of put together geographically where this community would have been located, which would have been along south of the Manatee River, west of the Braden River, probably some down into Sarasota. It wasn't a nucleated town. It was probably farmsteads spread out through this area. And then Vicki Oldham, who's a local woman from the Black community who wanted to tell the story of Angola when she heard about it. She wanted to make it part of our area history. And she put together a team of archaeologists. Dr. Uzi Baram for New College was the lead archaeologist on it. Dr. Rosalind Howard was an anthropologist who tracked the descendants of this community. And Terrence Week from University of South Carolina was another archaeologist who worked on it. So they put together a team to really try to find more historical evidence as well as archaeological evidence.
And you mentioned a slave raid. Can you expand on that? What happened here?
In 1821, when Florida became a territory of the United States, Andrew Jackson was the governor of Florida at that point in time, and he applied to Washington for permission to come and recapture the slaves that were living here in Florida. He was denied, but within 3 months, his Native American allies who had fought beside him in the War of 1812 came into Florida, came down the coast, did a massive slave raid between here and Charlotte Harbor, recaptured at least 300 individuals. That was written up in the Charleston paper. That we have that historical documentation that took place, this describing burning the plantations. We know from that point that some people, it's speculated that about 700 people may have lived here at that time. We know that the people who escaped, some went to live in the interior of Florida, probably alongside some of the Seminole areas. But others escaped to Key Biscayne, and with help of the British over onto Andros Island. And there is a descendant community still there in Red Bays, the very north tip of Andros Island. Rosalind Howard has done the research and found a document that listed the names of the slaves who were captured and taken north. Several of those escaped, and those names of the ones who escaped turn up in Red Bays, Andros Island.
And what do we know about the escaped slaves who lived here for some time before the raid? What do we know anything about them and what they were doing here?
We don't know a lot. Archaeological materials that we found, we've not done extensive excavations, but we found bits of pottery that date to that time period. We found bits of kaolin pipes, which date to that time period. We assume that, like other Maroon communities, that it was not a nucleated village. They would have had farmsteads, grown crops, lived here with their families. We don't have written documentation from that time period, so we can only make our best guesses from the archaeological evidence.
So now, is this officially, or is there still some process, is this officially part of the Underground Railroad? Is that an official thing, or are there some kind of still paperwork to be done?
It's an application we are making I am in the midst of writing the application to the National Park Service to designate it part of the Underground Railroad network. And we have to have our submittal in by July. And then they approached us. They expect it to be approved. We have so much documentation that's been done, reports that have been written, both the historical reports and the archaeological reports, that we have the evidence. It's a matter of writing the application and sending it in.
And so is this something that you were working on before the National Park Service, or something that you were reading about and interested in before the National Park Service approached you all?
Oh, yes. This is an overnight success of awareness after decades of research by many, many people. And the Looking for Angola project, got an awful lot of publicity back in 2007, I believe, that brought a lot of awareness, got the story of Angola into the curriculum in both Manatee and Sarasota counties. But it's still pretty much an unknown history within our communities. And we've had a number of lectures on it. Dr. Brahm has done innumerable public presentations about it, has written so many reports about it. But you put the National Park Service interest in front of that story, and all of a sudden, oh, there's a national park coming to the Gulf Coast of Florida. What's that story about? And people pay attention. So there's no question, and that is the importance of the Underground Railroad network, is that it brings credibility and it brings awareness to many places that otherwise would be forgotten.
What are the next? What is the future like for this spot? I mean, once it gets that that designation officially, what are next steps? I mean, is there anything planned for this area afterward?
Well, this spot is a designated historic park within the city of Bradenton, and the exciting part is there's a sort of a confluence of events at the moment. The city of Bradenton has a very successful Riverwalk, which is in downtown Bradenton, a lovely public space alongside the riverfront. And that is in the process of being extended, essentially, to where we are right now at Manatee Mineral Springs Park. So this will be the eastern terminus of a public park, which, again, will bring more people here. And as this is designated as a historic park, the planning process is just starting as to how to interpret the history here. And having the Underground Railroad noticed and knowing that the reason that those people were here is because of the Manatee Mineral Spring, this is all the more encouragement for opening up the spring again, which is currently just got a big cement cap on top of it, though you can still hear the water running underneath. To getting that opened and really allowing people to see the importance of why this area became where people always came throughout history, because people had to come and get their water here. And from the Angolans to all the later communities and the Seminole War engagements and the Civil War engagements that happened here, everyone wrote the fact that they had to come and get their water at the spring.
Hi, I'm Trudy Williams, Volunteer Executive Director for Reflections of Manatee, which are the original preservers of this piece of land.
Do we know why it's capped at the moment or how long it's been capped?
It was capped in the early 80s, basically because they felt that this was a playground at the time, and they didn't think that a little pool of water would be safe for little ones to be playing in and jumping around. So, but it's still could be the 12-foot pool of water that it once was. And the water comes out of a rock, so we're anxious to see it opened again.
Cool. And how does it feel for you, all of this happening to this park and getting the recognition?
Well, actually, I remember a letter back in 2003 from Senator Nelson, who said that they were happy that we wanted to make this a national park. However, here it is almost 15 years later, but it's still exciting.
I'm wondering, can we take a little tour, maybe?
Sure.
Like, just walk around and see what these signs say?
Yes. These signs were funded by the Florida Humanities Council in a grant about 5 years ago, and they tell all the histories, because even though what we're talking about today is about the Underground Railroad history, because of the spring, this site, this is why Manatee was settled. This is the beginnings of the city of Bradenton, was right here. And so there are so many layers of history, of which right at the moment Angola is what everyone's excited about. But each of the signs talk about a different period of history here. So Angola is the name of the settlement of the escaped slaves.
Got it.
We don't know if that's what they called it. That's the word that the historians have used, and it relates to Florida became a U.S. territory. There were two applications for land along the Manatee River, which spelled in the records was Angulo. And then there's also, of course, the relation to the Angola in Africa. So there are a number of clues as to what it may have been called, but the historians have used, I think Cantor Brown was the first one to have used it, calling in a very important article called Angola or the Sarasota community. So we use the term Angola. This shows on each of these signs, we've tried to not only tell the story, but actually show the documents, either historic or archaeological, that allow us to put forward this story. And so here we actually have a copy of the Charleston City Gazette from November of 1821, the story about the slave raid, the expedition that took place, and terror spread along the western coast of East Florida, is what that article says. And it then has the map of African Florida with the path that the people from here would have taken. They came south after a major event in 1816. The blacks had been allied with the British in the War of 1812, fought alongside the British troops in the War of 1812. And after that war, the British were ordered out of Florida. So they turned over a key fort to them, and that was on the corner on the Apalachicola River. After that, the fort became known as Negro Fort. And in 1816, a U.S. Army gunboat happened to blow up that fort. And so the blacks then fled, had a battle against U.S. troops, the Battle of Suwanee, and then came further south to this area, to the Tampa Bay area and south of the Manatee River. And then 1821 is when they had the slave raid that caused them to leave here, where they went to, some went interior Florida and some went to Key Biscayne and across to Andros Island. So the Third Seminole War, there was a branch fort was on this property. All right, Trudy, this is Trudy's deal.
In 1856, Dr. Branch had bought this land from the widow of Henry Clark, who had died in 51. And he built a stockade, and there was a military army camp here called Camp Manatee. And 220 whites and 150 blacks camped around this area. It was never attacked by Billy Bowlegs, but close by at Braden Castle, they did attack there.
And so who is Billy Bowlegs?
Billy Bowlegs was the chief of the Seminoles at that time. So I think it's because the settlers, these particular settlers, were friendly with Billy Bowlegs. In fact, he was known to have come and come into their homes and ate meals with them. So I think that's why they were spared. But one night they thought that they were going to be attacked, and they put all the women and children on a leaky boat. And the women bailed all night long, unable to sleep, waiting to be attacked. But they never were attacked. So after 18 months, they some of them had babies here, and they were 18 months old before they left. So it was a long encampment.
So the next sign we have here is about the Native Americans that lived along the river, and that is quite a long period of time ago. That was probably from year 900 to about 1700 that there was Native American. So we're talking about in the before the contact period or early contact period, there were mounds on right at where we're standing now. We've come off the river, and there's a small ridge. The property goes up slightly uphill from here on in. And that's where the Indian mounds, the first settlers write about the Indian mounds, and they would collect beads and to decorate their dresses from the Indian mounds. So there's no record of the Seminoles settling near here. So the Indians that used this property would have been prior to the Seminoles coming into Florida.
Wow. So we don't even know anything about them?
Well, we do. archaeologically, from in the early 1900s, there was a lot of investigation of local mounds, and that the South Florida Museum has really wonderful artifacts on display from Montague Talent, who was a local archaeologist at that point in time, and we know a lot about them from that and from early Spanish accounts of the chiefdoms on top of temple mounds, but it doesn't so much play into the story of this property. We don't have archaeological evidence from the excavations that we've done here on the Spring property, but the early archaeologists in the earlier 1910s do have information from the mounds that used to be up on the ridge. The last sign I want to talk about is the one about the archaeology, and the reason that we can say that the escaped slave community of Angola was here is because of the archaeology. And however, you know, we know that every group of people who's lived along this river has used this spring, and it certainly would have made sense for those people to have used it as well. We have the artifacts that date to that time period. We do a lot. We bring school kids out here. And I like to talk about historical archaeology in the way of how we tell the story and how we tell the various histories, because this place is so rich in history from so many time periods. And what I tell the school kids is, if you think of the layers of history, what you see on the ground today might be a gum wrapper that was dropped yesterday. And if you dig down a little further, maybe you will find a pop top from a soda can that was dropped 30 years ago. And if you dig down a little further, you might find a hat pin, because church groups used to come here on Sundays after church to have a picnic at the Manatee Mineral Spring. There was a big gazebo, and they would come, and we've got wonderful pictures of ladies standing at the gazebo. So maybe you'd find a hat pin. If you go down a little deeper than that, maybe you'll find a brass button from someone from the U.S. Colored Regiment that occupied this town during the Civil War and stayed at the houses that were right up the property from us on the other street. A little further than that, maybe you'd find some rough-cut nails from the early villages, in the early American village in the 1840s. And below that, you'll find a piece of a kaolin stem from a kaolin pipe that someone smoked here in the 1810s when the community of Angola was here. All those levels of history, all those stories are here at Manatee Mineral Spring Park.
That was WGCU's Jessica Mazzaros talking with Sherry Svekas and Trudy Williams at Manatee Mineral Springs Park. To view pictures and to find out more about that park, you can go to gulfcoastlive.org. They're also planning a Back to Angola Festival, which will run from July 13th through the 15th. That's coming up this summer. And you can learn more about that by listening to All Things Considered later this afternoon here on WGCU. Now, if you're just joining the show, we are marking the anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s death with a live program at the Blanchard House Museum in Punta Gorda today. This is another historically significant part of Southwest Florida, and I'm talking with Jaha and his mother, Martha. It's been such a great hour listening to you and watching you listen to that story from a little bit further north from where we happen to be right now. This is talking to that part of the hour. Talk to us a little bit more about the Native American and then the early settlements of African Americans coming down into Florida. And one of the things that I found most surprising just when I talked with you last week, Jaha, was about how the Underground Railroad wasn't always heading north. You said what? Out of three were heading south?
Yeah, actually, it was three times as large, but it was not popular from a political standpoint to talk about it, because going south, these were groups that moved to Negro forts where they were armed, and they pretty much resisted slavery, and as well as created communities where they came with natives who escaped from the wars as well. So they made communities what we call Seminoles, actually, where were African and indigenous combined communities. And so in Florida was a place in which if you can just escape to Florida, you could live freely. And so that, so because there were so many slave catchers, things like that, it was not trying to advertise the fact that if you came to Florida, you would be free.
Yeah, that would be counter to what they were trying to accomplish. And you said it goes all the way back down to the Revolutionary War. Tell me about that part of history.
Yes, if an irony was that if one chose sides, if you fought for the U.S. or fought for the British, fighting with the British guaranteed your freedom. Where if you fought with the Americans, it was questionable. So, it, you know, one point Florida was British territory. So those people who fought with the British during that time, when the British eventually lost their position in Florida, those former British forts actually became African-American-owned forts. And so this is why when you escaped to Florida across the St. Mary's, there actually were armed regiments that were ready to defend you if you could just simply get to the state.
I just find it so – and then that leads me to the marooned people. And you've Dr. Beretta, you've written a book about this, the marooned people. Who were these?
Well, it's a book for young people, OB – African Freedom Fighter, I believe it's called, and it's for young people. We did actually two or three exhibits here at the Blanchard House Museum. We got very much interested in the Southern Underground Railroad. In fact, a group of us, our historian, Scott Shively and his wife and Jill and several of us went up to the conference that was held in St. Augustine, mm-hmm. the Southern Underground Conference. And so I wrote this book, historical fiction, based upon this young African-American who escaped from a plantation in South Carolina and went through all of the trials and tribulations with him trying to get to the St. Mary's River. And then once he got there, he was greeted by the Native Americans. And then in this fictionalized account, he established a community. And they stayed in this community until the 1830s when Andrew Jackson, of course, was forcing the Native Americans to leave Florida. And over at St. Brooke in Tampa, you know, was where they were rounding people up or taking them out to Oklahoma and whatnot. And so in the book, and as what happened in the story, actually, with Abraham, a lot of people don't know about Abraham. He was what was called a sense bearer or an interpreter. And he worked with the U.S. Army, but he also, his first concern was his people. Mm-hmm. And so he, as he was working with the U.S. Army, he was talking with the Cuban fishermen to get supplies so that they could fight in the Second Seminole War. But anyway, when the groups were sent, there were groups who decided to leave Florida, who Abraham was able to secure, said that they would go. If they go to Western Territory, they would be free. So in the book, and it's what actually happened, these maroons went out to Oklahoma and to Texas.
Now, maroon is a mixed ethnicity.
Well, a maroon is one who escapes.
Oh, okay.
Okay, one who escapes.
And the word can be used. It was used to describe Africans escaped. It also was used to describe natives who also right. escaped. So it was just a word, escaped person.
Anybody
run away.
Escaped.
Yeah, a runaway.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
okay.
Yeah.
So these groups, once they went out there, a deal had been cut with the Creeks. Mm-hmm. Who were aligned with the U.S. And, you know, you could still go there and be enslaved by them. And so these people actually left. I went to Texas, and I was fortunate enough to go to Texas, the Fort Brackett, is it? I forget the name of mm-hmm. the fort. And from there, John Horse, who was one of the major fighters, took this group into Mexico. And so, very interesting, when I went out to see these descendants, and this descendancy comes from South Carolina, the Gullah, all the way to those who escaped to Florida, to those who went to Texas, and then on to Mexico.
Well, it's this whole theme of migration kind of then takes me to the Great Migration room that you have. It's a, mm-hmm. it's a temporary display that's happening. It's another migration. There
yes.
were two of them that happened.
Thank you. Thank you for like that. We didn't think about this.
Yeah,
yes,
I mean,
it is.
And you have rotating displays. So this is a great place to learn about a lot about the history of Florida, African-American history, the uniqueness of Punta Gorda and its African-American history, and then you have the rotating displays like the one talking about the Great Migration that happened, and I think it was the 1920s, and then again...
Well, 1910 to the Depression,
yeah,
and then after that, in the 40s, was the second one that happened.
Mm-hmm. So, and then that ended up seeing people going, you know, north out of Jim Crow South.
Yeah. 6 million.
That's a lot of people
moving. Yes.
And then what's an upcoming thing that you have coming up? You have the...
In September, I think it will actually be like the 22nd, we have the African Roots of Southern Cooking.
Are there going to be samples? African Roots of Southern Cooking. I really want to try this.
There definitely will be samples. The whole year will be consumed with food.
Okay, I will be here. I'll be back. And Jaha, before we run out of time, we're running low. We're at 57. We only have a few minutes left.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about one of the goals that you have for Punta Gorda as a city council person going forward.
From this point, I would say it would be to help facilitate the renaissance we're going through now. A little quick background. How Punta Gorda got to be this grand belle of Florida was that the deal with Henry Plant, the railroad magnate, was that for half of the land, he would bring the railroad here, in which he would build the big hotel. When bringing the big hotel here, and building the railroad here, it became a big place for a lot of industry. So it had like fishing and phosphate and cattle export and things like that. And so this became a very cosmopolitan place where it combined old Florida, the seasonal residents, and the Gulf Coast. And so this was a gilded age for Punta Gorda, where we really were a cosmopolitan small city. And so part of it is bringing back this age now. We're at a time in which, if we do, in terms of we've reunified our historic district, we're bringing things like electric cars here for moving people around. We're rebranding the city. We're right now looking to adjust our building code so we can bring back our historic downtown. So we can
put the shopping downstairs, and living upstairs.
Yes, shopping downstairs, living upstairs.
The walkable city.
Walkable city. Yes. Yep. So these are all things which I would hope to facilitate to do this now, because we've done this before. This is who Punta Gorda is, and really want to see it happen again.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for talking with me on this day. We are at the Blanchard House Museum of African American History and Culture of Charlotte County. Dr. Bereda, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for being here.
Thank
it's
you
always
so much.
A pleasure. I could just sit here and talk for hours, and I'm probably going to do that once we get off the air. Our show today was produced by Mike and Ira, Rachel Iacovone, and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1 WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.